entering more deeply into the forest of Sesshin. This Sesshin with lots of words, more talking, morning and afternoon. Let's receive words and practice expressing words in a way that's in accord with concentrating the mind and gathering the mind. And let's let the words of our great ancestor Dogen and ancestor Shrensha permeate our bodies and minds and encourage us to sit more openly and wholeheartedly. When Shrensha was 30, he realized the peril of the ephemeral world. He awakened to the dangers of the impermanent world and the loftiness of the Buddha way, and climbed Snowy Peak Mountain. He ascended Mount Shui Feng, and practicing with great master Junjue, pursued the way day and night. He gave up his fishing career to live on some mountain. Once, in order to practice with other masters elsewhere and to get to the bottom of the whole matter, he got together his traveling gear and was in the process of descending the mountain when his toe struck a rock and began to bleed. In pain, he had an awakening experience and said, "The body does not exist. Where does the pain come from?" So he'd been practicing with Shui Feng for a while, and then he went to go traveling, went on pilgrimage to go visit other teachers, and so got his things together. Just as he was leaving Snowy Peak Mountain, stubbed his toe, and in that pain he had this awakening. So in this case it's not the word Satori, as it often is in these cases, but it's this term Mose, which is like he had sometimes translated as a serious reflection or a strong turnaround. It's an unusual phrase. At least to me, it seems like it doesn't appear in these Zen stories so much. A strong turnaround or self-examination is one translation of this character, Sei. So he was probably quite an aware practitioner and in a very awake and aware state of mind as he's leaving his home temple to go traveling, and hits his toe, and enough so that blood came out, so maybe quite hard. And in this great pain, you know, knocking your toe and things is one of those really intense pains, isn't it? And but that was apparently what happened, is that he, in the middle of the pain, he had this self-examination, this strong turnaround, awakening. One translation says, a powerful insight or realization, and said, the body does not exist. Where does the pain come from? So, it sounds like he had heard this teaching many times in the Heart Sutra, that there's no body. The body doesn't truly, ultimately exist. And maybe he was a very settled practitioner, so that his body didn't bother him so much. He was a young man at this point. And so meditating on the emptiness of the body, maybe he had some sense of that. But then the toe hits the big rock, strong pain. Okay, wait a second now. This teaching of the Heart Sutra, that there's no body. Where does this pain come from? How does this happen? How can this experience be so vividly, strongly apparent and painful if this body is pure emptiness? So he turned back. Maybe he was leaving his teacher with some pride, feeling that I've had enough of old Shui Feng. Let me go see if anybody else has anything to say at this point. You know, I understand emptiness now. And then with his pain, something struck him besides the rock. Something struck his mind and felt, let me go back to Shui Feng. So he returned up the mountain, and Shui Feng asked him, what is this ascetic pay? That's his, you know, Sher Pei is his name. And he called him, he had this nickname because he was a kind of austere ascetic type, as Dogen mentions some things later. So he had this nickname, the Dutta Pei. So this is a Sanskrit word, Dutta, Japanese Zuda, which is these ascetic practices, austerity practices, and you can read about them like in the Path of Purification in the Pali tradition. There's a Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga. There's the chapter on the 13 Dutta. As I recall, this term Dutta is usually translated as austerities or ascetic practices. It literally means like shaking up. At least the Sanskrit and Pali etymology is like shaking up. So quite contrary to, I mean, maybe some similarity, but I think quite contrary to like ascetic practices in, say, the Christian tradition, where it's about just overcoming the body and kind of punishing the body because the true soul is trapped in the body. So Buddha never had that understanding, but Buddha sometimes called the supreme ascetic, and it's always been part of the tradition. Thus we have things like sesshin that tend to be long sitting, physically difficult, simple food and not much sleep and so on. That's in fact what these the Pali tradition has these 13 ascetic practices, and I think there's a Mahayana version that has 12, basically the same. They're they're delineated by Dogen in his fascicle called Continuous Practice. At the beginning, when he talks about Mahakashapa, that first ancestor, practiced these 12 dutta. But they're basically about, they're not about like being cruel to the body, they're just about simplicity. What might sound to us like extreme simplicity, but they're about limiting the physical desires of the body. So it's about limiting, I think like a third of them are about like limiting food, a third of them are like limiting clothing, and there's some about sleeping without lying down, and lodging, like living under trees and so on. So it's like these things that we all need as people. The Buddha said, don't ever stop eating food, don't ever stop sleeping, don't ever stop, you know, having a place to live, but you can use all these things in a very minimal way. And more about maybe examining where we're using these natural things that we need to live in a way that's like more than necessary, in a way that's maybe distracting us from the task at hand. And with these dutta in the path of purification, it's prefaced by saying these are not like essential practices. These are like optional practices, and the Buddha never said everybody should practice these, but a lot of people wanted to. It was part of the culture in India at that time. So Buddha said, if you want to practice austerities and ascetic practices, I'll give you a list of like ones that seem actually in accord with my Dharma, because they're the middle way. Although they might look kind of extreme, they're not harmful to body and mind. And they might be good for shaking up our stuck places, our habitual tendencies. And often they're taken on temporarily. That's a long aside on the word dutta, which is being used here. So he had this Zen nickname of dutta bay, ascetic pay. So Shui Feng said, what is this ascetic pay, or which one is ascetic pay? Or another translation is, what's happening, ascetic pay? Maybe he comes up holding his toe right now. This body is toe. What is it? Ascetic pay. you ascetic that aren't moved by difficulty with the body. Why are you seem to be in such pain now? And or, you know, who is this ascetic pay? And he says, Xuan Sha says, henceforth I shall not deceive people, or I never dare fool people, or no one can be fooled. And one other translation says, from now on, no one will fool me. But it seems like the majority agree that I won't fool anybody else. And one commentary says, this is a Zen teacher's commenting on this fascicle, saying this is an equivalent of the story that brought up here before about what is it that thus comes. The sixth ancestor asks Nan Yue, what is it that thus comes, when he first arrives at the temple. And Nan Yue goes back to meditation to investigate that for a while, and comes back and says, to say it's this misses the mark. Do you remember that one? What is it that thus comes? Or what is, kind of referring to him, who are you that thus coming here, but also what is that coming from suchness? To say it's this misses the mark, is his answer. To impute anything, even this is pretty straightforward, but even to say it's this, even to say it's such, misses the mark. To say anything at all misses the mark, because that's what words do, is miss the mark of suchness. So this one Zen teacher said, this is just another form of that same dialogue. Instead of what is it that thus comes, what is the ascetic pay? You know, who are you really? And instead of saying, to say it's this misses the mark, henceforth I shall not deceive people. Maybe you can see how that's kind of the same thing. We could see it as same story. And it's not so clear whether, you know, he went up there and bandaged up his toe and, you know, a few days later this happened, or if it was right in the middle of coming up in pain and like, who are you now in this pain? And, you know, his connection with that teacher was such that, yeah, maybe really turned him back. He took that question very seriously. Yeah, what actually is happening now with this understanding I thought I had, that the body doesn't truly exist, and yet what is this pain? I will not deceive people by, you know, saying my name is Shrensha. Don't you know, teacher? Why do you ask who I am? Or I will not deceive people by saying this body doesn't exist, or I will not deceive people by saying this pain is really real. I just, from now on, I'm not going to deceive people with words, including myself, by saying anything, even this. And funny little dialogue, but Shui Feng was delighted with this answer and said, everyone has the capacity to utter those words, but no one expresses them as Shirpei does. And then Shui Feng asked, ascetic Pei, why aren't you going on pilgrimage? And pilgrimage is his word, henzan, which Dogen has a whole fascicle called henzan about all-inclusive study, is one translation. So it referred to going on pilgrimage to visit different teachers, but Dogen uses it in that way, but also expands it to mean all-inclusive study of this moment, where you know, which doesn't require going on a long pilgrimage to do all-inclusive study. And yet, Dogen brings up all these old cases of people going on pilgrimage and having these Zen dialogues. But this fits, his answer here fits in quite nicely with Dogen's interpretation of henzan as all-inclusive study, because when asked, well, why don't you go on pilgrimage? Why don't you travel further to study? And because he had just come back with his full pack and now you're back again, why don't you go back now that you bandaged up your toe and you won't, and I know you won't deceive anybody anymore, why don't you go ahead with what you were doing beforehand? And Shrensha answers, Bodhidharma did not come east, the second ancestor did not leave for India. And this answer also especially pleased Shui Feng. So it's about people traveling, right? But they didn't really go anywhere. Bodhidharma didn't come east from India, and the second ancestor didn't go west to leave China. So therefore, why should I go anywhere? I'm here now. Maybe not so much like I just don't feel like traveling anymore. My toe is kind of bad now, and because you praised my answers, teacher, I'd like to practice with you a little more. It was more just like in that moment. This is how I see it. Just in that moment, it's just actually nobody ever goes anywhere. That's how I see it now. At this time, nobody goes anywhere. And you know, maybe that I'm going to like leave again in 5 minutes or 5 decades, but actually nothing's really happening. Even though, obviously, Bodhidharma appeared to have come to China. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here in the, practicing Zen. So, these two sides. There's always these two sides. There's the strong experience of pain, and there's this body doesn't exist. There's going on pilgrimage, and Bodhidharma never came from India. Yes.
What struck me, I think it's common with what you're saying, but what struck me when I read it is that he, unlike Bodhidharma and the second ancestor, was going off to seek something. He wanted to seek somebody else's opinion about it.
Yeah.
And this has happened to me. And the mind is very concentrated. Find pain. So what I saw is kind of like the end of seeking. It's all right here. It's all right. There's no need to, to go anywhere else. And in this sense, Bodhidharma did not go east to find anything. His ancestor did not go to India to find anything. Why should I go anywhere to find anything? I can find it right here. Is that consistent?
And maybe what he found was that integration of emptiness and form that actually he was leaving the mountain saying, I really understand now that I've heard all the, I've studied the Heart Sutra and the Sandinirmochana Sutra for so long now. I understand it's all empty, and like, let me go test, either seek further explanation or maybe go test other teachers or just, you know, I think in some ways this we can see this pilgrimage as seeking, and in some ways it's portrayed more like like you after some degree of understanding, then there's just going, not so much seeking something new, but more like refining expression by meeting all different kinds of personalities of different teachers, and then interacting with them to like just bring out Dharma. We're going to do it to bring out Dharma. But let's say there was he was seeking to kind of further, maybe he understood conceptually this body doesn't exist, and he wanted to experientially truly realize emptiness. I'm going on pilgrimage to do that, and then this pain comes, and it could be that was the experiential integration of this body doesn't exist. Where does this pain come from? These two sides are all one piece. Right now, there's just this one experience. I know this body doesn't exist. Truly, it can't logically exist according to these teachings. And yet, here's this. Boom, they're like integrated. Now there's no more need for further study. It's like, and in fact, often it seems that the full integration and realization of these two sides is in times of great difficulty. It's often not like everything's empty and like, you know, I'm lying on the beach and on a perfect day and just like, what could ever be wrong? This must be verifying emptiness. But it's often like in sesshin or in some great pain and examining that this what is this? Is this really happening? No, but yet it appears to really be, and these two sides come together. And the end of seeking, and then seeing that, yeah, Bodhidharma, like you say, wasn't seeking. He was, I think his teacher did ask him to go to China, spread this.
To give something.
To give something. Yeah, to give something, right? And maybe that insight that he had of the integration of form and emptiness, of pain and emptiness, was shifted the seeking mind into the giving mind, which was like doesn't have any particular form. So it's not like I have to stay here and help this teacher, I have to go and help others. It's more like I'm just here right now, and Bodhidharma didn't go anywhere.
Well, the form of his, I mean, I could see it having a really sweet, got praise from everybody, you know, trying to move on and expand. Mm. I can see losing track of the form and saying, oh, this is, I am one with all.
Mm-hmm.
And then stubbing the toe
completely
smashes the form,
which
makes me realize that wasn't emptiness at all. You know, it's more emptiness involved in what the hell.
He had an idea of it, maybe, and then this strong experience was like, now I have this idea that seems to be contradictory to what's happening now, but yet I know it's not, and on some level they both came together, and to realize emptiness as form is the purpose of the Heart Sutra. That form is emptiness and emptiness is form. It's such a radical statement. And the strongest experiences of the solidity of form are things like stubbed toes. So, to go on. Having been a simple fisherman, Shuangsha had never encountered the many sutras and treatises, even in his dreams. Oh well, I guess he hadn't studied the Sanjaya Mochana Sutra. But probably the Heart Sutra. They just chanted that, you know. He had never encountered the many sutras and treatises, even in his dreams, but when he put his determination foremost, he manifested a spirit that surpassed that of others. Shui Feng considered him to be superior to others and praised him as an outstanding disciple. His clothes were of coarse, simple cloth, and because he always wore the same ones, they were covered with patches. His underclothes were of paper, and he used mugwort for padding, which sounds like a weird image to take like leaves of mugwort. But then there's a footnote explaining that this was a common practice in old China in the poorer areas, where they took not the leaves, but more like the stalks of mugwort, and they pounded them out flat and wove them together. And I guess the fibers are strong enough to make like kind of rough like padding inside clothing, but probably the cheapest way. Simply, maybe he made himself. And how paper clothes work, I'm not sure how that works out. Apart from his practice with Shui Feng, he had no other teacher. However, he experienced the power of succeeding to his teacher's dharma straight away. So Dogen likes to praise the simplicity of these ancestors, and that's kind of one of the ascetic practices. Actually, it's literally one of the 13. Is like wearing only cast-off rags. So, you know, that's the origin of our patched robes that we cut up and patch and sew together is this collecting scraps and sewing them together. And now we have our cutting up whole cloth and sewing it back together. Yes.
Well, I'm focusing on that line about succession.
Mm-hmm.
Having only one teacher.
Yeah.
In the first hour, I mean, you read so many interactions. You know, the relationship obviously was playful and close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sounds like here that Dogen is praising him for only practicing with this one teacher. Maybe not, it's not that explicit, but usually when he brings something up, when he's praising somebody, it's like that. And but then Dogen, maybe it is Dogen's relationship to this term Henzan, which meant going off to visit various teachers, and then Dogen's reinterpreting as all-inclusive study of this moment right now, here. You don't have to go anywhere to do that. In a way, it looks like that Dogen, in his personal relationships, like his teacher Qiantong Rujing, that he often praised him as the one teacher in all of China. And of his personal teachers, he didn't really he did mention Asai, who he maybe met like once in his earlier days at Kaninji. But we can see that as not kind of an exclusive thing, but more just like his devotion to this teacher, and something about turning back in this moment of, we're not sure what that was about, but about to leave, you realize something. We have various Zen stories about people on their way out, often with some arrogance, and something happens and they turn back and then they have an awakening. On there because they're more open when they come back, they're more open than when they left. This kind of has that flavor, it seems, that he's like, there's something, like, what's going on here? And so I go back, and then they have this dialogue, and maybe he's able to express something that he couldn't earlier.
Dogen say that the only teacher is Dharma.
Well, ultimately.
And it wears many faces.
But he also seemed to be very into the many faces, the personalized faces. But yeah, one Dharma with many faces.
So
but
all good teachers are basically meant to reveal the Dharma.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it's about.
So, a thoroughly engaged single teacher can accomplish everything that engages with many teachers can accomplish if they're all teachers that reveal the Dharma.
Hmm. Could be.
Yeah. Okay.
Hmm. So this he seemed to just have this austere kind of quality, Xuanxia, and here's one of his talks that seems to point out both these sides, and maybe like how that kind of practice fits into Zen. This is later when Xuanxia is teaching. He says, "It's as if all of you are sitting on the bottom of a great ocean, completely submerged, and you're still holding your hand out to people and begging for water. Do you understand? So you're submerged in the ocean, and please, I just want some water. You know, classic Zen image. Do you understand? If you want to realize wisdom and bodhisattvahood, you can do so if you have great wisdom ability. With great wisdom ability, you can do it right now. But if your basic ability is somewhat lacking, then you have to be diligent and press on, day and night, forgetting about food and sleep, enduring as if both your parents had died, being in just such anxiety. Give over your entire life, and with the help of other people, truly endeavoring for the truth, you'll certainly reach awakening. So, you know, if you can see that you're in the middle of the ocean and there's nothing to get anywhere in the slightest, then this is it right now. But if you can't quite open to that, then diligently press on and maybe take up austere practice and you know, forget about food and sleep and so on. It sounds more like he's saying, maybe he's not even recommending, he's just like, you'll just have to do that. Maybe he's just admitting, like, yeah, that's you're probably going to feel like you'll have to do this. And indeed, that's how the Zen tradition seems to keep being expressed. There's that side of, like, the seeking side of, like, I don't understand this, I have to practice harder, with, you know, the example of the founder, Shakyamuni Buddha, as the great original example of, like, I must get to the bottom of this, I will not turn away for anything, and all these ancestors. And yet, we're right in the middle of the ocean, looking for water. And another really wonderful dialogue here is, a monk asks Xuanzha, what is it and why is it so hard to realize? And Xuanzha says, because it's too close. Yeah. Those were two questions. Sounds like he's not going to answer the first. What is it? But why is it so hard to realize? Because it's too close. Or that's what it is. And that's why it's so hard to realize. It's so close. And later, Fa Yan, a couple of generations after Xuanzha in his lineage, said, commenting on this story, said, it couldn't be closer. Actually, it's the monk himself. The monk who asked, what is it? It's him himself. And it's so hard to realize because it's not even slightly outside himself. This is why I say to you that the eye of a true practitioner envelops the entire world. It encompasses the whole universe. Not a single strand of hair leaks out. So where would there be a single thing left for you to see or realize? This transcendence, this miraculous state, why don't you investigate it? So many of these golden age classic Zen founders talk this way, always pointing back towards the ultimate, and this is typical. So this is Xuanzha, the five. So part of one of the five houses, kind of a forerunner to the five houses. And Thomas Cleary says that actually the Fa Yan house that he's a few generations before Fa Yan, some old Zen collections say that actually the Fa Yan house was really a kind of just elaboration or refinement on the Xuanzha house. It was never called that, but he was such an important teacher that it was more like he had his own style, Xuanzha, and it was a really important ancestor. It's just that Fa Yan got the house named after him. Everything is our always so. Every essence is as such. Do not seek outside. If you have a great root of faith, then the Buddhas are nothing but your own inner experience. Whether you are walking, standing still, sitting or lying down, never it is not so. If you have a great root of faith or trust confidence in the fact that everything is always so, then the Buddhas are nothing but your own inner experience. There's nothing, as we've been studying these three natures, there's nothing to do about imputational nature. It's just realizing that the imputational nature, that our words and concepts don't ever hit the mark. Don't ever reach suchness. Well, maybe more accurately, according to the sutra, suchness is defined as the words and imputations not reaching the appearance, the non-reaching, the absence of the imputation in the dependent appearance. But now that I've told you this directly, already I'm oppressing your freedom, making you slaves by even saying anything at all. Would you agree to say so? Whether you agree or not, how do you understand? Now, this talk is already showing ignorance of good and bad. How so? Because you discriminate this way and that way. He's also into asking a lot of questions. And there's several times where he says, how do you understand? You know, whether you agree with me or not, like, you know, say something. How do you understand? Later he says, what are you all taking such pains in search of? Don't tell me to flap my lips. Why? There's nothing accomplished by talk alone. It's not words that can bring people peace. You must experience unity and suchness before you attain harmony. Don't just memorize sayings and expressions, for there's no end to that. It's just a matter of total concentration. Don't say you have to attain the function of the sages before you can be free. How are you unequal to them? So, this encouragement that, like, it's always here, we're lacking nothing ever from the start. And yet, how is this so? The emergence of Buddhas in the world exercising kindness and compassion has been all along like flowers in the sky without solid reality. So we have this image from the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra of sky flowers, like illusory appearances due to faults of cloudy, of distorted vision. Due to cataracts in the eye, we see what appears to be flowers, but they're just appearance. They're not really flowers. So here, the emergence of Buddhas in the world exercising kindness and compassion, that's been like flowers in the sky. How sad. How wonderful. without solid reality. You should realize that there is that which has never emerged in the world and has never entered extinction. Sounds like the ultimate that has never arisen or ceased and is naturally in a state of nirvana. Illusory manifestations and illusory names have no reality. It's so hard not to keep thinking of this three characteristics of all phenomena as a model. Manifestations, illusory manifestations and illusory names have no reality. The appearances, the manifestations and appearances and the names that solidify them both have no ultimate reality. Why? The essential nature, Svabhava, probably, the essential nature of the material elements is fundamentally actually empty, so it has never passed away and never come to be, and it has never taught people. In other words, emptiness doesn't teach us. It's not something that actually has some function. It's never passed away and never come to be. Because the essential nature of beings is such, their material bodies are also such. Because the essential nature of beings is nirvanic, they're naturally in a state of nirvana, their material bodies are also nirvanic. But do you realize this? If you do, then come forth and we'll all discuss it. If not, I now tell you that intrinsic essence, self, inherent existence, does not produce intrinsic essence, and intrinsic essence does not annihilate intrinsic essence. So there's no practice, no actual practice can ever remove this inherent essence. This is kind of a nice little discussion about what we could call inherent existence or self-nature or the essence of things. The essence of things is not caused by the essence of things, and it's not removed by the essence of things. Because actually, it's a lack of own being in terms of character. In other words, it doesn't actually really arise, therefore it can't be annihilated. Then how can one attain understanding? If there's nothing that we can do to remove this illusion of essence, how can one attain understanding? Don't say this essential nature is as ever. If you understand, please express your understanding to the people. If you don't understand, then how are you not comparable to the Buddhas? If you do not understand, then how are you not comparable to the Buddhas? There's a lot of playing with the words understand. If you don't understand, then how are you not like the same as the Buddhas? This is how you must be before you attain. Those of higher faculties comprehend everything once they hear. Those of middling faculties also comprehend once they hear. Those of lesser faculties also comprehend once they hear. What am I talking about with this reasoning? Do you know? Do you have insight? It is inherent in everyone. It is manifest in everyone. The first axiom of Zen is to personally accept the completeness of present actuality. There is no other in the whole universe. It is just you. Classic Zen talk. Very, very encouraging. Nothing is lacking. Nothing needs to be done. Not only nothing does nothing need to be done, nothing can be done. And yet, and yet, Xuanzha, you know, left everything and wore these paper clothes and mugwort. Throwing his whole life into the effort to get to the bottom of this that's already here. Questions about how to receive such things, practice with such things as we sit period after period. Nothing we can do about any of it, and we have this unique opportunity to just express this life, all three characteristics of this life, every thought emerging as it is, sometimes held as a big problem, sometimes seen to be a thought of such, and all the manifestation of the appearance of each moment of the life of sitting, what looks so plain, and like you think from looking from behind that every period of zazen would be exactly the same for each person. But we know it's far from that. But that each moment of all that experience has these two sides, that we're swimming in the ocean, that nothing could ever be lacking, whatever confusion or pain or sleepiness there is. And then this, you know, adding on our running commentary to all of it. And then it's the way that the running commentary never actually touches the actual sitting. May the one bright pearl envelop the whole world of suffering beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.